This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This episode, we're talking all about sexual assault as a factor in mental health with a brilliantly inspiring writer and mental health advocate, Charlotte Underwood. She's someone I've been following online for some time and has a really brilliant blog that I enjoy reading, so I'm delighted to have covered this sensitive topic with her. One thing I wanted to also mention right at the top of the episode is we do talk about a period when she was feeling suicidal, so that's just something to be aware of going into this episode. So before we get into the interview with Charlotte, we're going to start off with a definition of sexual assault from the Metropolitan Police. The overall definition of sexual or indecent assault is an act of physical, psychological, or emotional violation in the form of a sexual act, inflicted on someone without their consent. It can involve forcing or manipulating someone to witness or participate in any sexual acts. So that definition I really loved in that it's so broad and it includes a lot of sexual assault types that aren't always considered. And that's, you know, that's really great to see coming from a particular definition from the police, that they've made sure to make it really clear the range of things that can be considered a crime, including, for example, being pressured to witness a sexual act. Someone like Harvey Weinstein really comes to mind for that one.
Exactly why I loved it. I thought, well done, police. Because you're right, I thought about, imagine 50 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10, it just wouldn't have been so detailed as that. And although it's a long definition, it needs to be. And I think, like you said, with social media as well, and just even witnessing, participating, seeing something that you don't really want to be looking at, all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really a great sign of how far understanding has come. You know, even in the time I spent working for West Midlands Police, we had coercive control training because they were trying to make the officers more aware of different types of abuse. And so I was able to witness firsthand how the understanding is growing about how broad different types of domestic violence and abuse within relationships can be. And so certainly coming from that biased police background, I'd always be someone to encourage, as long as you do feel comfortable, absolutely report anything that you may have experienced similar to what you hear in this episode to the police. Even if you don't then want to take it further, there's options to, in most cases, close down a report if you do want to withdraw the accusations.
Yeah, I looked at that. You can actually report what's happened without pressing a charge against somebody, can't you? So you can be on file, your case, and if in 6 months or however long later you wanted to come back to that, you could. I think there's an ability to be able to document that you've been through something, even if you don't want to take it further.
Yes, that's right. There are kind of complications and limitations to it, but Absolutely there is that option in many cases to put something on file.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is very useful for officers to be aware of something that's gone on, even if it doesn't go further. Because then if anything happens with that particular person involved with somebody else, it's something that they may be able to take into account, depending on how that case is handled. Of course, not everyone does feel comfortable reporting sexual assault or related crimes, and I believe that is completely valid too. But I just wanted to say my bit of a piece about how the police in particular are getting better and better at how they handle these types of crimes. And there is a key stat that I wanted to mention from the Office of National Statistics relating to this as well. That is that only 15% of those who have experienced sexual violence report it to the police. So that one was really key, because 15% is so low, and I think that really is a big part of how much kind of shame and stigma there can be around these types of crime, but that should never be put on the victim. They've not done anything wrong by being victim to a crime. That's just not how it works. And so, you know, that's something maybe to bear in mind if you're weighing up whether or not to make a report. It's the other people that you could help, and it's preventing this happening to others. We can't change what's happened to us, unfortunately, but we can change how we respond to that. And certainly people like today's guests are inspirational examples to me of how you can bring so much positive and so much insight and learning from such a difficult experience.
And there are also charities and support groups that you can go to if you don't feel that you can talk to the police, but you do feel that you want to talk to somebody.
Yep, and that's absolutely important. One example of that would be rapecrisis.org.uk, yeah, who we've got some stats for up next. And they've reported, as part of the Crime Survey for England and Wales that was conducted in 2017, 20% of women and 4% of men have experienced some type of sexual assault since the age of 16. That's equivalent to 3.4 million female and 631,000 male victims. So a stat like that, unfortunately, doesn't surprise me, having been involved both through police work, through Samaritans, through volunteering I've done with victims of sexual assault and rape. I am not surprised by the level of it going on, but I am really glad we found stats like that just to kind of hammer home that if you do relate to anything you hear in the episode, you're far, far from alone. It's actually far more common than I wish it was. But in that, there is at least allies and support services out there because of this demand. And so Rape Crisis is definitely one you should consider. In fact, there's a whole range of different helplines you can go to. And we do have some of those resources listed on our website, mentalpodcast.co.uk. We've also found some stats from the Office for National Statistics on to what degree this affects people's emotional and mental health. So 63% of victims suffered mental or emotional problems as a result. 53% reported having problems trusting people or having difficulty in other relationships. And finally, 1 in 10 victims attempted suicide as a result. Of course, really hard to hear. I've had a lot of people in my personal life go through experiences like this. And so for me, any discussions around the prevalence of these issues is going to feel very personal to me. It was at times a tricky interview to conduct for that reason, in that it does feel so personal, and I feel very protective over anyone that experiences sexual assault. But I'm really glad that we covered it, and I'm so grateful to Charlotte on how open she was able to be with me on something so personal. Is there anything you wanted to mention about those stats, Danielle?
It's good that we've highlighted there's a high percentage of, you know, sexual assault that happens within people that you know.
Right.
Not necessarily just family, but within people that you know. I think there might be a misconception at times when we talk about rape and sexual assault of it happening outside crime.
Absolutely. The more we can understand to what degree different variations of this are common, we can better understand when we might be in a compromising situation and hopefully feel more empowered to get out of that, because you understand that this can happen.
Yeah.
That just because they're my partner doesn't mean
it's not classed as assault, yeah, or rape.
And yeah, doesn't mean that they don't still need to seek your consent.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's really important to note. So we do talk about that more in the episode, and in particular how Charlotte was able to better understand toxic elements of a relationship she was in and to what extent it wasn't normal and that she did need to get out to protect herself. And so I'm really glad to have covered that side of it.
Yeah.
And get such insight into her journey of understanding how to reassert boundaries that she'd got used to someone else taking ownership of.
Wow.
It is a powerful interview. It is an emotional one to listen to. if this is something that you've experienced, it may be something you want to consider listening to with somebody else, or if at any point you feel uncomfortable or it's bringing up memories of something that's happened to you, maybe just be mindful of taking a pause and going to get a glass of water if you do want to continue listening. So was there anything else, Danielle, you wanted to add about Charlotte's experience?
One thing about Charlotte is just that, you know, she's just such a brave woman, you know, and the strength that you need to be able to talk about these things, it's just inspiring for other people. You know, it takes a lot, and often the effects on her mental health and how she's dealt with that since, just to me, shows so much strength. And I'm just so encouraged by that. We often see things as weaknesses, or we feel, you know, we can't cope with things, but being able to talk about it and just getting through the next day, you know, she's a survivor. And I love that. So from, you know, from that point of view, with regard to Charlotte, I think that. And just lastly, there's been a massive report that NHS released about their strategic direction for sexual assault, and it's lifelong care for victims and survivors.
Yes, absolutely. I would totally agree with that. And I don't have anything else to add. So we'll get into the interview with Charlotte Underwood in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Charlotte Underwood, and I've dealt with mental health for as long as I can remember, but I don't think I really understood it until probably about 5 years ago when my father passed away. I had a lot of struggles growing up with social situations and dealing with my emotions, and I ended up being an alcoholic at 14 and self-harming and going through some really hard times, but I sort of felt like I was the only person that went through it because no one spoke about it. And obviously that only left me feeling really quite miserable at the time because I didn't know what depression was. It's when my father died by suicide that I was like, oh, this is more than me. This is a bigger thing. This is a bigger picture.
So you'd experienced symptoms kind of growing up, but it was really when that happened with your dad that it really kind of hit home, it sounds like, how important managing your mental health was.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you come from a family that doesn't talk about it, your emotions and feelings are just sort of pushed aside, and I sort of got used to pushing myself and ignoring what was going on. But seeing my dad, who was this really amazing man who had been a medic in the army and was a prison officer for over 20 years, and he had all these wonderful stories and never stopped learning. He had so many qualifications. The fact that I had no idea what was going on, no family member did, and he dealt with that all on his own. The fact that he went through that and so was I, and neither of us spoke about it, it really struck home, and it was the first time I really realised the bigger picture.
Right. And that's unfortunately still so common, that people try and deal with this internally and they don't open up to other people. So it sounds like in seeing it in someone else, it really highlighted how much you were not being more open about your experiences, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you see like people going through things on the TV, it doesn't feel real, and it's really hard to completely understand it. But when it's right in front of you and it's someone that you've viewed in a certain way for so long, it is quite shocking to suddenly see this other side and realize, wow, we've both been going through some really bad stuff separately and neither of us knew what was going on.
Yeah, it's really tough, and that's something that I've definitely felt a lot in my family, that we don't talk about our feelings, and that actually other things, you know, our work, our how our day's been in terms of, you know, social interactions, in terms of what we've achieved, is so often put above how we feel and how we're doing emotionally. And I think that does create a norm for you growing up, that you start to think, okay, well, we don't talk about emotions, so maybe there's something bad about how I'm feeling. Maybe the way everyone approaches it is that you don't talk about it.
I think the way I felt growing up is that there wasn't time for it. So there wasn't time to feel a certain way. and almost like you're not gonna achieve anything if you listen to those feelings, which that's all I knew, so that's what I did, but I didn't realize the effect it had on me long term.
Right. And do you mind sharing a little bit more of what that effect was?
I think sometimes there is obviously a place for pushing through it, and it's a very good thing for dealing with anxiety to sometimes push yourself a little bit. But because I was doing it all the time, what started as just worry that became more chronic anxiety, which I'm living on today, meant that I now have to deal with worries where sometimes I can't leave the house, sometimes I can't handle going to the corner shop or opening the door to the postman because I get really intrusive thoughts, and it really controls your life. And I say with the depression, that started off as my mood declining over years and years and years. And you can see it through my school reports, how my whole personality is just dropping. And that led me in a hospital bed, like with a suicide attempt. But I don't think you realise it, what's really going on, until you're in that dark place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the guests we speak to on the podcast, they seem to reach a certain breaking point, that there's a kind of sometimes quite gradual decline, but actually it comes to one day either something happens to them or they just reach a point of clarity where they realise, I can't go on living like this.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that.
And so was there a clear point for you where you realised something has to change now?
I think there's been a few points, if I'm completely honest. But a lot of the time, I'll get in these phases where I'm so determined to get better, and then I crash again. And so it becomes a cycle. And that's the thing about recovery, it's so up and down. But it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years ago where I was so scared of the world. And I think I was just crying in the spare room in my house. And I realised how isolated I was from my husband, from my job that I just quit, from being suicidal, and my family. And I just really shut myself off. And I really felt sick because I knew that it wasn't what I wanted, and I'd come so far from what I wanted to be, because I'd have all these hopes and dreams, but I just somehow lost track of it. And there I was, alone, crying on the floor, not knowing how I possibly could leave that room, let alone the house, or deal with tomorrow. It was a lot on that day, I think.
And that's quite a common experience when it comes to mental illness in general. I think that it can so much isolate us. It's a naturally internal process trying to cope anyway. And then if you're not getting all the support you need, or if you're not communicating enough how you feel, then it just makes you feel even more isolated. That's certainly been my experience.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
And so were you aware at that time to what degree having experienced sexual assault was influencing how you were feeling?
It's tricky because I went through sexual assault twice, two very different ages, two very different people. And I think the first time it happened, I just got on with it and it didn't really faze me. And I came to accept that one and cope with it and manage it. But the second time went further. It took me 3-4 years, I think, about that, to realise what had actually happened, and that what this person had done was not okay, and that it was not their entitlement. And suddenly I just had that voice in my head and I was like, Charlotte, you were raped. And after going like 5 years, 3-4, I can't even remember the dates, that's how I'm getting flustered. But from ignoring that since the age of 16, 17, and then suddenly having that click when you're 20, 21 years old, it's very, very heavy. And it's all that pain you've been collecting all those years just bubbling up. And it definitely clicked that makes sense as to why I'm pushing people away, why I don't like being touched, why I'm always looking out the window and scared. And it's led to this whole phobia. And it was funny because I was talking to my psychiatrist a couple of weeks ago about it. And I said the events very casually because it became so normal to me what I went through, because I feel like sometimes when you go through something, even though other people can say to you, it's not normal, if it's all you know, it is entirely normal to you. And that's how I felt. So I told the psychiatrist that in that way, as a matter of fact, as this happened, and they just looked at me and just said, are you okay? Like, that's a lot to go through. And that was only a few weeks ago, and I think it really shocked me to think, all right, yeah, it is, isn't it? Like, that is a lot. It's a pretty tough thing, yeah.
Absolutely. And certainly with people that I've spoken to about this in the past, they've described something quite similar, where there was, in every case I can think of, a period of them not acknowledging what happened, not using the word rape or not using the word sexual assault. That is such a major step to start to come to terms with the extent of what happened to you, but it can also re-traumatize you because it causes you to relive it in a way that's more honest maybe than you've previously thought through the situation.
Yeah, I mean, the whole event was so scary, remembering it, that I, in my head, it feels like the more I think about it, the more I talk about it, the higher chance they'll reappear in my life. It's that I feel like even if you're not processing it straight up, it's still processing in the back of your head and it's still creating these thoughts and feelings.
Right.
And so when you accept it, all of that stuff that's been going on in the background of your head is shooting out at you like nothing else.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because you are, when you think about it, you are reliving it. And so it naturally creates a response in your body. You know, it's not just mental, it's a whole physical response. When you have PTSD over a traumatic event, your whole self is reliving it. By partly reliving the trauma, then feel more traumatized and more under threat, because when the feelings and the response within you is so strong, it's difficult for your mind to distinguish the danger you feel now as not actually being danger right now, because it feels so real.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a way it almost feels like a bit like when your computer's lagging and it's not quite loading. And that's the only way I can really describe it as to how that felt, like coming to terms with it. It was still there, the page was still up, but it was just taking its time to quite buffer and really show itself. That's all I can describe it as.
Yeah. And do you mind sharing a little bit more of what happened?
The first time was, it was the first relationship. It was all very innocent. And then in a matter of days, it went like, we'd be cuddling and his hands would go elsewhere and then apologise for doing it. And that would escalate into literally exposing himself, demanding it, and then crying because I would say no. And because I'm quite emotionally driven, I felt guilty for it. And I was angry because I was like, but this is what everyone's doing at my age. I must be the one in the wrong for not wanting to. Is there something wrong with me? It wasn't until this person said he wanted to go the whole way without protection that I was like, no, because I knew that that was not, I was not there. And that was my absolute red line, red tape. No way. Then again, I was so infatuated with this person who I thought was so perfect. And it was really great for a while, but things became quite emotionally abusive and things like the police got involved. And so I was dealing with this side of it. But meanwhile, that was happening, I was falling asleep at night and waking up with my pants down my ankles, or waking up and keeping my eyes closed because I didn't want to look up at the person who was on top of me at that time, because I felt that if I confronted, I would be in the wrong and I didn't have the right to say, what are you doing? That's wrong. Again, because I felt I'm the girlfriend, therefore they have this right. And it had been warped into my head that I was the problem and I should just accept it because I'm lucky to have someone like me, and I should be lucky and feel lucky that someone wants to be with me like that. And it kept going on and on. So
yeah, and I understand that way of you thinking was very convenient to both of the men in that situation, that you doubting yourself and feeling that you're in the wrong for wanting to have your consent respected, or your lack of consent respected. that's very conducive to them continuing this behaviour, for you to blame yourself and not them. Was that something that they actively encouraged you to think like that?
I feel like the first time, we were both very young, and I feel like it was more of a culture thing, like everyone's doing it and there's a pressure and stuff, and I feel that it's not excusing what we've done, but I don't think there was the emotional manipulation. I think it was wrong, but there wasn't a bigger picture.
Yeah. However, there was still the difficulty of it being asking forgiveness after things had happened rather than consent up front.
Definitely. And the second time, as I said, there was this thing going on behind the scenes, and this person had me completely twisted around their finger. They befriended my family, so they became like a son. My friends were controlled. I didn't have my own life. I was owned by them, essentially. And so I think after a while, someone comes across so perfect that you believe it. And when they slowly test that, but only slightly, and they play the emotional card and the, oh, but what if I died? Or I would never hurt you, but I could if I would, and things like that. You become scared of them, but you also still see them in this light, because even though there's that abuse, you still had a relationship, you still had feelings for them, you still went on perfect dates, or they'd buy you flowers and chocolates. And so it really messes your head. And before you know it, you're sort of sitting there and feeling like the only person's feelings that matter is that person, not yours, not your family, not your friends, just this person. And it feels natural and normal, even though, I guess, deep down, you know that's not the case.
Right. And I think that's, to some extent, a natural part of us as humans, that we try and stay away from conflict. It's self-preservation. And so if they've convinced everyone else around you that they're so perfect, then it can feel easier to believe that than your own instincts.
Yeah, I also remember feeling guilty. I remember staying with this person for the sake of my parents, because I felt guilty. And that was a bigger part of it, because they loved that person so much that I felt like I was removing that from their life rather than protecting myself. I don't know if that really makes sense, but
no, that absolutely makes sense, that you were looking out for everyone else around you, and that's really admirable. But the difficulty is, when you're in an abusive relationship like this, no one else is going to understand the extent of it. And I certainly have experienced that myself, where it's only been in hindsight and with a lot of explaining that people have been able to understand how toxic a relationship I've been in was. Because at the time, you're just trying to be a good partner and to get along, and also get along with your family, and just trying to keep everyone happy. And so that absolutely makes sense to me. And when that person is also manipulating you, then it is a lot easier to blame yourself than to blame them, because they're testing your own idea of what's reality constantly. They're constantly undermining your genuine experiences and making you question them, because then you'll believe them. You'll listen to what they're saying over your own instincts. And that's very conducive to abuse.
Definitely, I agree with that one.
And so when you were in that relationship, to what extent were you aware of how abusive it was, and to what extent your consent wasn't being sought out or respected?
It was complicated, because I was so infatuated and in this person's control that even when the police came to me and said, this is what this person's done, and I went upstairs and I cried, and my dad followed me in and said, you know, let's talk it out. And he even said, you need to do what's best for you. He didn't pressure me. And yet still, a matter of minutes later, this person comes through the door and I'm like, oh my God, I forgive you. It's okay. We can get through this. Even after everything, I was in this for over a year. And I think near the end, I don't think it was that I even noticed the abuse or the rape that went on. it was more so that I was so emotionally numb and I didn't really feel anything for them. And I no longer felt like I liked them, but I didn't know why. So I called off out of that reasoning that clearly my heart wasn't anymore, but it was, I definitely didn't think at the time anything that this person had done was wrong at that time. I was still convinced it was me and my feelings that were the ones that had gone and faded and caused this breakdown.
Yeah, I understand that, particularly when you're in a situation where that's been constantly reinforced by not only the partner but other people around you, then it's very easy to believe that it is you, that things are okay. Certainly with an experience I'm thinking of with myself, I felt a lot that I couldn't live without that partner, that if we weren't together anymore, I wouldn't be able to cope. And that was a big part of me, I think, ignoring warning signs. Is that something you experienced as well?
Oh yeah, we were still young teenagers and this person had proposed to me. And despite me not feeling happy, I was so focused on becoming happy, if that makes sense. I was trying to be like, well, maybe things are rough now, but they'll definitely be better because this is the only person that's ever going to love me. And this is the only person that's ever going to make me, you know, feel this way. And it was very easy to get wrapped up in those big romantic gestures and ignore everything else, because it almost felt like the abusive side of it, which I didn't know was abuse, but the nastiest stuff, it almost made it okay, because at least they're buying me flowers, at least they're proposing to me, at least they're doing all these great things. I think it's hard to see what's actually going on when you're in that position.
And so when you did then reach that point of ending the relationship, what was that process like? What happened?
It wasn't overnight. I know it was about 3 months where I was thinking, should I break up with them? Shouldn't I? And then I would have conversations where I was going to bring it up, and then they would do or say something that would either scare me or make me think, oh, that's sweet, and I wouldn't. And there are other times when I was thinking, if I do this now, what's going to happen afterwards? Will I be happy outside of this relationship? What will my parents think? And it was very gradually me getting more and more deflated, I guess. And I think the ending point was just me feeling completely flat, and I just ended it because I just couldn't, I didn't have the energy and I didn't have the strength, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do anything at that point in time.
When you had then ended it, how did things change for you?
It didn't stop. I think there's a miscommunication that things like sexual assault and abuse and all these things where someone's manipulating you for their own gain, it doesn't always stop when you say that the relationship's ended.
Right.
It doesn't always end there. I still had to deal with them playing games with my friends, turning up to my house to try and take my mum out to coffee dates, trying to walk through the house and get into my room without asking for permission, starting rumours, all these things. They were still trying to control my life. So while I felt freer, in a sense, that I could have my breathing space, because for the first time in a year, I got to be alone, and I was never allowed to be alone. So to actually be on my complete own felt so good just for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But then I'd wake up and all this stuff would still be happening on the outside, and I felt trapped still. I just had a bigger cage.
Right. And that's something that I think a lot of people experience, where because of how the person reacts when you do get out of that situation, it can feel like it's easier to go back into it. And that was something that I used to always make sure to bring up when I worked for the police. And one of the things I would need to do is take reports of sexual related crimes. And I felt that was something that wasn't often stressed enough to the victims. So I'd always make sure to emphasize that there will be times when it'll feel easier to just go along with it, get back with them, do what they want because of how they're behaving. Was that something you experienced as well?
Oh yeah, I completely agree. This relationship wasn't a complete straight line. I had had small breakups with that person, and by the end of the day I was always back with them because I felt that I almost couldn't breathe without them because they'd almost consumed me and it didn't feel right to be away from that. And so I thought I was doing myself a favour by going back to them, and that's what would make me happy.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the scariest things that a lot of people don't understand is that when you get out of a relationship like this, because of the controlling and manipulative nature of them, it can be difficult to know where that person starts and ends and where you start and end. That it can be almost like you then get out of the relationship and you don't recognize yourself because you've been so different in order to survive, in order to not piss them off, in order to tiptoe around them and not make them worse. You've had to shrink yourself. And, you know, in that naturally, you can feel very consumed by that.
In this year, I had had my appearance completely changed from my hair to my makeup to my clothes and my whole wardrobe. I was doing a completely wrong course for my liking. It's because it was all girls. So it suited this person. I didn't have the same friends. By the end of it, and I looked back on photos of myself at that time recently, it's not me, it's this other person, and I do not identify with any of that who I was at the time. But it still felt scary to lose that, because at that time all these things I don't relate to now felt like they were me, because it felt like they were helping me find my best version. But obviously that's not the case.
Right. The survival can become kind of familiar and homely in a strange kind of way. And one of the things that I think is really important to note is that actually when you do leave a relationship like that, them acting out and them trying in increasingly elaborate ways to control you and to get you back into their fold is actually a sign of them losing control. Even though it can feel like they're at their most controlling, they're actually acting out more because they have less control than normal.
I've never thought of it like that at all, but that's weirdly comforting in a way. Yeah.
I think for me anyway, that's the way that I've learned to look at it, particularly when talking to people about this subject and trying to help them understand that this person increasingly trying to control you more and more to win you back is actually a sign of you escaping, not a sign of them becoming more powerful. When you were able to gradually get out of the relationship, how were you able to better understand who you were again and better able to reconnect with yourself?
I think in all honesty, I made a lot of wrong choices until eventually something felt right. And I kept taking small steps, finding what felt right and what didn't, and rediscovering who exactly I was before all this, because I'd forgotten a lot of what it felt like before the relationship. And it's only been in the last few years, with the support of my husband and Twitter has been a big help and a lot of self-discovery, where I've really found myself as close to possible as I think I am myself. But it's just through relearning and rediscovery and taking the time to actually listen to and understand myself and my thoughts rather than what other people are saying. I've been more selfish, but without necessarily trying to hurt people or in the wrong way. It's more putting my feelings above other people's opinions in the situations that matter.
Right. Absolutely. A certain amount of self-focus is actually the healthiest thing for you at certain times in your life, and actually for everyone around you. And it sounds like you really needed to take the time to get back to you. And actually, in doing so, you were going to get back to having healthier relationships with everyone. Because a relationship like this, it's not just about the person you're with. It affects your relationship with everyone else as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm at a place now where the only relationships that I have are ones that feel healthy. I don't have that kind of toxic feeling in my life anymore, and I know to remove it when it's there. So the relationships I have are thriving and they feel great and they're supportive and they're kind. And it feels a world different from back then. My whole mindset and the way my body feels and the way my head feels, like, it almost feels too good sometimes, some days, because it's, I think part of me still magnates towards the past in a way, because it was so familiar for so long and I was so controlled that there's still that tiny part of me there. In few words, I think it's hard to explain.
No, I absolutely get that. And when someone is manipulating you in that way, they are actively trying to make you think that you are happy when you're not. And that's why this can be so complicated from a mental health perspective, because when you have gone through sexual assault, rape, any kind of sexual abuse, it does so much undermine your identity. That person has spent so long trying to gaslight you into thinking that you're happy when you're not, and that things in your life are right with them when they're not, that then it does really complicate your mental health process. How easy it is for you to assess how healthy your mind is, to what extent you need mental health support. And even when you're out of that, there's that learning process you described of getting back to yourself and understanding what is the baseline happiness for you again and where your mind actually is.
It almost feels like this person's come into your life and they've helped you to rewire your brain, but in a way that serves them.
Right.
And you leave it there so long that it feels like it works best, it's the most functional. When you're out of it, you realise that you need to rewire it yourself, and it can be really scary to know how to do that or where to go. So it makes sense that you'd want to rush back to the person that did it in the first place.
There can be a strange kind of nostalgia to it, I find, and that's something that I found really difficult to come to terms with, that my longest term relationship was the abusive relationship that I've had. And it can be really difficult to equate that in my mind sometimes, that the thing that I managed to keep going the longest was the relationship I shouldn't have been in at all. That can be difficult to come to terms with and not feel a kind of nostalgia for, in a strange, twisted way, because it did feel familiar.
I get that, though, because one thing I have learned is, in all this twisted irony, the most abusive relationships I've had have also been the most romantic, the most spontaneous, the most fairy tale feeling ones. Yeah, you can think that it's this good thing, and it's easier to be nostalgic over that feeling.
No, I get what you mean, that I think to some degree relationships like that have to have all those pretty moments to balance out the abuse. And so, particularly when you're in it, it's easy to press together all the good times and think that that's the relationship, because at times it can be easier to believe that than to acknowledge how horrible the situation you're in is and how unhappy you are. And so, having come out of that now and having progressed so much in terms of your mental health, what kind of support helped you to recover?
Talking about it and admitting it. It sounds so simple if you don't really relate to it.
Right.
But I think the hardest thing when you've been sexually assaulted or you've been manipulated for a long time or a short time, it stresses your body out and it can really change the way your brain works. So to admit that what they did was wrong and that it was not your fault and that you're allowed to feel this way and that you shouldn't have to keep suffering, and to be able to get to that point where you can think that and talk to someone you trust about that and actually pitter open into the big world, because it's really scary to say the words out loud,
yeah,
that it's actually happened. Because there's so much taboo on it. So to be able to tell someone out loud in person, that's a really big step. And it's probably one of the scariest steps there is. But it helped me. It really did.
Yeah. And that is so tough, is acknowledging it and saying it out loud, because it's so opposite to what the relationship has been like. You know, this relationship that to some degree, in order to survive it, you have to believe is healthy when it's not. For you to then admit that it was the opposite, and it was the opposite the whole time, and verbally acknowledge that, can be so difficult because you've been doing the opposite for so long. And I certainly had to go through the process of overcoming the shame around that, that I had been so wrong about a relationship that I was part of, can be really difficult as well.
Yeah, it's really not easy. It's hard to quite describe it, like, in words sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're doing a very good job of describing it. And so having gone through that experience and progressed to a place where now you're actively an advocate and a writer inspiring others, have there been any key breakthrough moments for you, like a particular type of support you got or a particular realization or conversation you had that really empowered you?
The biggest realization, it sounds so simple, but I think from what I've gone through, it wasn't simple in my mind, is seeing other people talk about what they had been through and then talking in bits and pieces, because I still struggle to go into details because I still live with fear every day that they're watching, lurking, trying to find a way to hurt me. And it's a traumatizing thing that sticks with you for a long time. But it was just learning that not one person is entitled to another person. And that was really hard for me to realize, that just because you're in a relationship, you are not entitled, because I feel like it's often forgotten that relationships don't equal sex. And me learning that was hard, because my whole teen years had been focused about the best thing you can do is get in a relationship and have lots of sex. That's what proves your worth in society. That's how I saw my teen years, and it was hard to rinse that off and see through it. But my relationships now are way healthier because of that. And
right. Yeah. And that's such an important message, that it doesn't matter the situation. It's always your body first. You're always the one that owns it. You're always the one that gets 100% say on consent. And unfortunately, I don't feel in our society that message is strong enough. And I don't personally have the answer to that, because historically, things like marriage have, to differing degrees through history, involved a certain amount of ownership. And I'm really glad to hear that you realized that no one has the right to your body. It doesn't matter the situation, it doesn't matter what your relationship, who the fuck they are, it's always your body first. Because a lot of people sadly go through their whole life not realizing that, and that's why I'm so delighted you're now another person that people can look up to and see that survived this, and hopefully draw the same inspiration and breakthroughs from.
It unleashes a whole new perspective on life when you realize that. It feels really good to know that it's your body, because they said it is so forgotten in society. In truth, the only thing we really own 100% is ourselves. So we should be able to respect ourselves enough to look after that and to protect it. And other people should respect that too. It's difficult to navigate through society, I think is what I'm trying to say. But it's good when you can take back that inner empowerment and look after yourself, because we can't do much ourselves if we can't look after ourselves.
It seems that as horrific as these experiences have been for you, over time and with the right kind of support and outlets and speaking up, you've really drawn the insight from them. You've still taken the good of it, and it sounds like you've really applied that in the relationship you're in now, and it's so much more healthy as a result of that.
Definitely, I think all I could do was try and make some form of positive out of something really negative. And it's not only helped me, but I've had conversations with other people in my life, and it's helped them come to realization as to what they've been through as well. And from my perspective, from what I've learned, is a lot of people have been assaulted or they've been raped and they don't know it or they don't realize it. And it's not until I've spoken about my story with them and they've spoken about a similar situation and I've had to say, but you know, that's not okay, right? If you didn't give consent, if you didn't feel right, if you refused it, that's not okay. And I guess that healing myself has helped other people healing, even though it's still a really awful situation for anyone to go through.
That's all you can hope for. Unfortunately, we can't change the past, but we can choose where we go from it. And so, sadly, we are coming near the end of our time now. I would love to talk to you for so much longer. You're such a delight, and I think it's quite clear how much I resonate with your experiences. If people want to know more about them and follow you online, particularly your Twitter, I find really ace. Where should they go?
At C_UK is my Twitter handle, and that is the easiest way to find me because I practically live on there, as people that follow me know. So that's your best bet.
Brilliant. And one of the things I love about how you share online is it is very honest. That so often there can be this kind of trap in how people talk about mental health, that you're either ill or you're well. And the reality is far more fluctuating than that. And so I personally really appreciate how honest you are about your good and your bad days.
I think the biggest lesson that I've learned and that's helped me is that the only person that can define and value who you are is yourself, and you should not let anyone do that for you. That's helped me a lot through the years.
Yeah, that's a really great message to end on. And in addition to that, I'm planning to drop some resources in the intro as well. So do rewind back to that if you do want to access any further support regarding the themes we've talked about today. So thank you again so much, Charlotte, for being part of the show today. It's been really nice talking to you, and thank you for sharing so openly.
Thank you for having me and talking about such a taboo subject.
Of course, it's the only way. Thank you.
Definitely.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.